Good morning. I'm Alexis Strauss-Hacker. I'm chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board, and I welcome you to today's board meeting. We'll call the roll for our board members in just a minute, but first some logistics. Our meetings are hybrid, so in addition to in-person participants here in the conference room, we may also receive public comment through our Zoom meeting platform. If you're not physically present and intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you need to be in the Zoom meeting space and not watching through our webcast. If you haven't already received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link on the agenda for today's meeting. And after you register, you'll receive a Zoom login link providing access to our meeting. If you're in person and wish to speak, you may also register online or with the assistance from our team at the registration table outside. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will promote you, and you will need to unmute yourself on your computer or your phone so that we can hear you. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the room here waiting to speak, you'll be called by name when it's your turn. Please make your way up here to the podium so we can best see and hear you. All speakers will be given 3 minutes for commentary, and we ask that you state your name and your affiliate organization, if applicable, when called upon. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to a good meeting. I'd like to ask Julie Haas, our clerk for today's board meeting, to call the roll.
Good morning. Can you all hear me? All right. Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Beelen.
Here.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Batty.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger. He raised his hands here.
Here.
Beautiful. Vice Chair Young.
Here.
And Chair Hacker.
I am here. Thank you. We have a quorum physically present for today's meeting. Welcome, everyone. Item two is public forum. I'd like to open our meeting to the public forum. I want to remind everyone that public forum is for items that are not on the agenda today and items that are not a pending or impending matter, meaning they're not about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. Please confer with our board clerk, Julie Haas, here in the front if you have any questions. I will call on each of the public speakers who may have registered to speak. If you're remote and haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform. That way we'll know to call on you. Do we have any registered for public forum?
Yes, we have Mr. Ellsworth. Mr. Ellsworth he's been promoted.
Good morning, Mr. Ellsworth. Please go ahead when you're ready.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Hello, Chair Strauss-Hacker, board and staff. Jeff Ellsworth here, former mayor of St. Helena, Napa County from 2018 to 2022, and now a member of the California League of United Latin American Citizens, CALULAC, Napa Valley Waste Worker Advisory Committee. I'm sure you're tired of hearing my voice. I assure you there are other things I would prefer to be doing, but when it comes to matters of civil rights and racial equity and public safety, I cannot stand down. I wanted to share with you today a recent, and I've submitted it as well, 2025 coalition letter from California LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, in support of impacted Latino waste workers with workplace safety complaints related to wastewater and civil rights complaints at Upper Valley Disposal Service Clover Flat Landfill in Napa County, as well as advocating for closure of Clover Flat Landfill in Napa County. I'm attaching that letter here. Contamination, fire risks, and civil rights concerns at UVDS Whitehall Lane in Napa County also need to be addressed. The California LULAC advocacy letter will be going out broadly seeking support for public hearings on this matter with sworn testimony at public oversight agencies such as the Water Board. I've also presented this matter at the California LULAC State Convention in Los Angeles, April 25th to the 27th, and at the California Civil Rights Department Commission on the State of Hate and California State Department of Fire Services. I've also continued to present this issue and similar comments to the California State Level Water Board. We've recently heard that the U.S. Justice Department FBI investigations into Upper Valley Disposal Service and Clover Flat Landfill have paused. This is no surprise considering the current concerning tone of the federal administration towards racial equity and civil liberties, making it even more important for our California state agencies like the Water Board to walk the walk on civil rights concerns consistent with your own policies and California laws. At the April 15, 2025 State Water Board meeting, the director of this regional water board stated there was no need for hearings with sworn testimony. Respectfully, such a response does not satisfy the need for objectivity with a report coming from the very entity in which the complaint is lodged against. The complaint, including that the recent regional water board investigations did not factor in all relevant documentation or interview key witnesses like neighbors at these waste sites. For the sake of fairness, public safety, and civil rights concerns, this matter needs the open and objective analysis that would come from a public hearing with sworn testimony. If there is not a problem at these Napa Valley waste sites, such objective scrutiny shouldn't be objected to, and I continue to urge you to agendize a public hearing with sworn testimony on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ellsworth. Do we have
Lisa Dunseth?
Before we switch to her, I'd like to turn to Board Member Batty.
Thank you. Mr. Ellsworth, I don't have a comment on the substance of your remarks, but I did want to express my appreciation and the appreciation of our board for anyone and everyone who comes out and speaks at a public forum. I can't think of a time in my life when speaking up in any appropriate venue that you can find is more important. So thank you for being with us. We are not tired of hearing from you, and I appreciate your representation of your community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Batty. On to our next registered commenter.
Apologies. We have Lisa Dunseth from Solutions Not Sandbags.
Please go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Yesterday, we took a walk along Crissy Field. It was a beautiful sunny day. There were lots of people and dogs, including groups of preschoolers with their teachers, frolicking in the water at the beach. We came home and noticed an email from the SFPUC alerting us to the fact that the water at Crissy Field was at unhealthy levels and to stay out of the water. We had not seen any signage at Crissy Field alerting anyone to this, and we also wondered why there was such an alert on such a spectacular, beautiful day as it was yesterday with no storms in sight. So we came home, we logged on to the SFPUC meeting to complain about the closing of the Pierce Street outfall and how that has created horrible sewer flooding for the people who live along Marina Boulevard. I noticed that their agenda included approving contracts for their consultants, like AECOM, each for an amount not to exceed $4.8 million, and then another one approved not to exceed $6 million per contract. That is a lot of money. I wonder why the SFPUC bosses don't listen to their own staff and prefer to listen to their consultants instead. Because their staff told them that if they closed the Pierce Street outfall, there would be sewer flooding along Marina Boulevard. And there was. But they listened to their consultants instead, who told them, no, it would be okay, go ahead and close it. When I read City Attorney Chu's statements about SF versus the EPA at the Supreme Court, well, he really makes it sound like San Francisco is the most misunderstood and innocent of victims. And I know that that is not true. And that's the reason I'm here today to once again thank you for your work. It is no small task to try to force a big machine like the SFPUC to do the right thing, especially when they are fully armed with huge amounts of money from their ratepayers who are people just like me. Thank you again for your attention to these important matters.
Thank you for your comment. Do we have another commenter?
No additional registrations online.
Do we have anyone here presently who wishes to comment during public forum? I don't see any. Thank you all for your participation in this part of our meeting, your passion for water quality in the Bay Area. The public forum is now closed. Let's turn to item three, which are the minutes of our most recent April 9th board meeting. Let's look at those board meeting minutes that were in our packets and posted online. Do we have any edits or revisions to the minutes? Seeing none, may I please have a motion and a second to adopt the March board meeting minutes?
I'll make a motion.
Second. Excuse me.
Julie, would you please call the roll? I misspoke and referred to them as March.
The motion was Board Member Batty, and the second was Board Member Beelin. Board Member Ransom?
Aye.
Board Member Beelin?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Young?
Abstain. I was absent.
And Chair Hacker?
Aye. Thank you. The April 9th, 2025 board meeting minutes have been adopted by the board. Let's move to item four, board member updates. Are there, I'll just call by name and check in with you. Board Member Ransom, do you have anything you wish to add?
Not today, thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Beelin?
Nothing now.
Board Member Batty?
I'll just say a quick thank you to the team that put together the Water Quality Coordinating Council.
Committee.
Thank you. Excellent program in Sacramento a couple weeks ago, and thanks to everyone who put work into that.
Board Member Gunther?
Yeah, I wanted to first say that I thought that Region 2 shined like a bright light at the WQCC, and everybody should be very proud of that. There was much jostling about who has the best region, but I don't think there was any doubt to answer that. I wanted to share, and I hope I'm not having a senior moment and forgetting I already did this, but at BCDC a month or two ago, we had in light of the accident in Baltimore, and where the ship knocked over the bridge, we had a little informational hearing about whether that could happen here. While there was much discussion about the strength of the bumpers around our towers or whatever, I have to say that I was rather unconvinced by the discussion. The Costco Busan, which just had a glancing blow to the bumpers on the bridge, was only a 65,000-ton vessel. The vessel that hit the Key Bridge in Baltimore was 385 tons, and 85,000 tons, pardon me. And the vessels of that size routinely go under the Bay Bridge. In fact, the vessels that go under the Bay Bridge are so big, some of them can only do so at low tide. The kinetic energy of a ship, if we all go back to our basic physics, is 1/2 mv². And so the way that you can reduce the kinetic energy available for a collision is by slowing down the ships. Me saying that makes me very unpopular in some circles. Similarly, there's the possibility of having a tug escort at that point in the transit. This, of course, was the answer to preventing more oil spills in Prince William Sound by having a tug escort for every tanker that goes in and out. I'm going to be investigating this a little bit just because this is stuck in my head now, and I've got to try and figure out what the likelihood is of an accident like that happening here in the Bay and what we can do to avoid it. But I wanted to bring it to your attention that that's something that is being pondered, and I'm going to be getting an informational briefing at some point from the Caltrans and MTC, who I believe are the two agencies that are doing the engineering about this. Thanks.
Thank you. Board Member Kissinger?
Nothing for me.
Very well. Vice Chair Young?
Nothing for me. Thank you.
And I'll go last. Our board was well represented at the aforementioned gathering in Sacramento a few weeks ago. Of all the 9 regional boards with our state board colleagues, over a couple of days. This happens once a year. And on behalf of our board, as Board Member Batty noted, we want to thank Meredith Thompson and the State Board Chair for preparing the agenda and hosting us so well. Eileen, would you like to commence with your Executive Officer report?
Sure, thank you. I'd like to begin first by taking a minute to introduce to our board, Stephanie Yu. She's the new Assistant Chief Counsel for the San Francisco Bay Water Quality Control Board, and she's stepping into the role that Amel filled for us. And I'm thrilled she was able to be here, come down from Sacramento to be with us in person today. And I'm going to turn the microphone over to her for an introduction.
Thanks, Eileen. Madam Chair, members of the board, it's delightful to be here. Again, I'm Stephanie Yu, and I am the new Assistant Chief Counsel for Regional Board Unit 1, which includes Regions 1, 2, 3, and 5. I have been with the Office of Chief Counsel based in Sacramento for a little bit over 9 years. Prior to that, I was in Washington, D.C., with the federal government, U.S. EPA, and U.S. Department of Interior for about 12 years. So I'm really glad to be here and look forward to working with you more in the future.
Thank you so much for coming in person. Is there anything board members wish to add?
I'll just make an addition. Stephanie and I have already been introduced because I had a thing I had to deal with. Financial filing stuff. And Stephanie was of great assistance and just picked right up where, and Amel had already briefed her, expect a call from Jane. And so I just want to thank you and welcome aboard. We're happy to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. I'll return to Eileen for the rest of your report.
Great. Just as is the way of the world, we've been welcoming new members and sometimes have to say goodbye to others. So I want to highlight a retirement from our team. As you saw in the executive officer's report, Alec Noggle, who's here today, you can stand up, Alec. He will be retiring in June after serving the public and the board for over 25 years as an engineer and geologist. Alec has been an invaluable member of the leadership team, the water board throughout the state, because of his knowledge and his expertise, and he's always been committed to our mission of preserving and protecting the Bay Area's water resources. Most recently, Alec has led our Toxic Cleanup Division as the division manager, supporting the many transitions over the last several years as we've hired new supervisors and new managers and new staff, and he continues to share his knowledge. His calm, clear demeanor, and his subtle sense of humor will be greatly missed. And we will begin the recruitment process later this month, but I felt it was appropriate to really wish him well and thank him for his many years of service. So thank you, Alec. Yay. And then just one other thing you'll notice at your place on the podium, I provided each of you of a copy that I picked up last Friday at SFEI, San Francisco Estuary Institute. The publication is called Science to Inform Management, an overview of the nutrient management strategy for San Francisco Bay. And I think, as I mentioned, when you adopted the permit last July, the San Francisco Bay Water Board, the Bay Area Water Agency, scientific research institutes, non-governmental organizations, and the San Francisco Estuary Institute created the nutrient management strategy over 10 years ago to better understand and respond to San Francisco Bay nutrient concerns. We're very lucky that was established so that we had the science to be developed over the last decade, and we've been appreciating the collaboration from all the partners. And I also want to acknowledge that a key part of the collaboration is the wastewater agencies in the Bay Area have contributed over $15 million in the last 10 years to the scientific monitoring, modeling, and studies to better understand the nutrients in San Francisco Bay. And having that strong collaborative science program made our decision to include scientifically defensible nitrogen limits in our wastewater permit last summer much easier, rather than needing to implement more stringent limits on a precautionary basis. So basically, I want to give you a copy of this document. It's the first time that we've synthesized 10 years of studies into a level. You don't want to see all the models. There's all these different web pages you can go to. There's all these models. But we wanted to synthesize high level so that board members and the public can understand what we've learned over the last 10 years, and in particular from the harmful algal bloom that occurred in 2022, which was a critical condition for the nutrient permit we developed last year. So I just want to wish you all happy reading, and we look forward to continuing this collaborative journey with our stakeholders to further understand the Bay's response to nutrient and how we can adaptively manage this situation more effectively. So I had a great meeting with the Bakwa community and all the stakeholders last Friday, and we got copies, and I wanted to get copies for our board. So just wanted to share that with you. So that ends my highlights.
Are there any comments from board members or questions for our executive officers? Board Member Batty?
I must be feeling chatty today. I have a couple of things on the executive officer's report. I'm going to ask both questions, and you can take them however you want. The first is about the Valley of the Moon Water District aquifer storage, which I thought was very interesting and hopeful for the future. I don't know if I didn't read closely enough, but I wanted to get a sense of what percentage of their water needs does that aquifer, would that, if it all works, would it provide for? Like, is that a year? Is it...
I think, because that was the first of the pilot studies, I think they're still trying to determine how much. They don't know at this point. But the good news, the pilot study was successful, so now they can take it to the next stage, and they'll continue to learn more. So hopefully within a couple of years, we'll know more.
Okay, but it sounds like it's substantial.
It's yes, because it relies so much on groundwater, so it's and it meets the governor's, you know, strategy for a hotter, drier climate that he put out in August of 2022. So we're real excited, and our team has been really working collaboratively with them to get this project moving forward.
Yeah. And then my second question, which I said I was going to ask, but I didn't. Second question was about the PG&E remediation on the San Francisco piers, and I found this timeline just stunning, how long from when this impact first occurred to the evaluation, and now it looks like we're moving into actually doing the work, which is also very constrained seasonally, it sounds like. And I guess I wanted to know, is that typical for something of this size, or has it been longer for any particular reason?
I would say it's typical. Our cleanups, and we're just lucky that we actually have collaborative partners at the table who are paying. They had a big media event last year. So they've actually been very collaborative, working with all the stakeholders. As you notice, there's a dredging window where they can do the work. So we've actually been very pleased, and the Port of Oakland's and Port of San Francisco's part of it too, that they've been working. I was at a meeting, 2 years ago, May, a big public meeting in the marina on this. So they've done extensive outreach. It's a bad set of circumstances, but it does take a long time to clean up our sites. It can take decades. You'll hear later today from another site on the Hunter's Point, which has been going on for several decades. So these are complicated sites, a lot of times multiple parties. This one in particular has PG&E in the Port of San Francisco, multiple regulatory agencies. But we're happy where it is.
That's good to hear, and good to hear that there's good partners. Thanks.
Are there any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for this document. You said this has been distributed to all BACWA members?
Not those who were at the meeting last Friday. We had a nutrient management strategy team, which includes the BACWA board members, but not necessarily all 40 agencies have gotten it yet.
Is Central San a BACWA board member?
Yes, and she was there, and
I wanted to make sure they got this.
They got it, and I was at a workshop at their offices a couple weeks ago, and they're embarking on some great pilot studies for nutrient management reduction while looking at recycling, so they're really committed to working towards the permit goals.
Well, congratulations to you for bringing them along. I was very interested in the in lieu fee program.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand this, as if I'm having some modest impact, I can put money into this in lieu of mitigation myself, then Ducks Unlimited mitigates on hopefully a bigger regional scale. Okay. I think this is really an important thing for us to be doing. I'm really glad. The growing pressure for regulatory relief and permit, whatever that means, and it means different things to different people, is a very real thing. And for us to have a more efficient way to achieve our objectives, I know that this is probably very popular with some of the people who participate. And I recall, in terms of supplementary environmental projects, that a lot of agencies would much have preferred to just be able to give the cash to somebody instead of actually run a project themselves, and to have then be able to accumulate these funds to use them on what are truly regionally significant efforts. This is something that I hope we're really going to be able to develop, expand, and tout as we go forward, because I think this is going to be a really valuable effort. How long has it taken to get this in place?
I think it's been a few years. Liz Morrison, 5 years, you say? Yeah, five. Liz has been leading it, and it is huge. That's why I put it as the first item in the executive office report. It is huge. It is huge. And it's what stakeholders have wanted, but all these things take time to get, but we got there.
Well, I recognize. That's why I'm asking, because I just seeing this made me realize somebody did a lot of work to get this across the finish line. And when you say stakeholders, this is something that is popular across the region?
Go ahead.
It's not popular with all environmental groups.
Uh-huh.
Because there is sort of a risk-reward aspect to it, and there is concern. If you look at the history of in-lieu fee programs going back to Tennessee Valley, where money was given to with best intentions, but there wasn't a lot of oversight, not much was done. Now, this is going way, way back. Alexis might remember, too. But since then, there's been a lot of learning, similar with mitigation banks. A lot of them really failed initially. A lot of project proponent mitigation also failed. And there's been a lot of learning over the 50-so-odd years that mitigation's been going on. And now there's a lot of checks and balances with the in-lieu fee program. Some of the folks that need to get mitigation, especially for really small impacts, I think will really appreciate this, and it will really help. Folks who have really large impacts, they probably will want to do their own projects themselves because it might be more cost effective. They're going to be charging the same rates as the mitigation bank so that we don't create imbalance with our mitigation banks. Which should generate actually extra revenue to do additional projects beyond the ones that are needed for mitigation. Some projects like eelgrass and derelict pile removal, you don't get a lot of acres from that per unit dollar. So they're very costly for really small areas. So hopefully, and Ducks Unlimited plans to do this, that they're going to use some of that extra money to take on some of these projects that are a lot more costly but don't provide a lot of acres. But they're hugely important to the overall ecosystem in San Francisco Bay.
Okay, yeah, thanks. And again, just echoing Jane's comment previously, I keep hearing these stories of how we accomplish things across, like, decades. And I come back to the staffing workforce development part of our strategic plan as something that is really essential for us to be able to achieve our goals and to have someone like Alec, who's been with us for 25 years. I mean, that we can't do what we set out to do if we don't have that. I hope that we can develop this story a little bit more about how long it really takes to restore and clean up and to plan ahead. The last thing I just wanted to verify is that we are planning for the contingency of another algal bloom this summer.
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to add a postscript on the program with Ducks Unlimited. And as you mentioned, Xavier, looking back, there were times when the state and EPA had audited mitigation banks sometime afterward and found them to not have been maintained or achieved their intended goals. So I'm very optimistic with a large and well-regarded sponsor like Ducks Unlimited. And Eileen, at your discretion, it would be nice a year hence if they would like to come back as an informational item and let us know how this year of implementation what has been accomplished and what do they look forward to doing. And that way I think we can begin to sort of stretch that narrative of what's possible with this. So thank you for that. And I also, on behalf of the board, wanted to thank Alec for his service, for his accomplishments, and for having both meaningful work and fine colleagues here at the board, and to wish you well as you make your way to Port Townsend and all the things you're going to do next. So thank you, Alec. Very well. Any further comments?
Alexis, I just had a quick comment on Alec's retirement. So I just wanted to say congratulations, and that, you know, as a board member hearing reports and on toxic cleanup sites, I've been impressed by the work that his team is doing. But also, you know, for the last 40 years in the Bay Area, working with his group on toxic cleanup sites, I've just been really impressed with his team, how diligent they are, how timely they are, and what a great job they do. So, hats off to your work, Alec, and just wanted to wish you well in retirement, and you're leaving some big shoes to fill. Thank you.
Yeah, make the most of the remaining weeks here. So true. Nothing further on this item. I'd like to go back to our executive officer. Thank you for always an interesting and thought-provoking report. We know you take care as to what you bring to us, and we really appreciate it. Let's go to item 5, which is the main item on today's agenda. And as mandated by the Clean Water Act, the triennial review of the Water Quality Control Plan.
Great. So the Basin Plan is the master policy document for the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board and contains water quality standards and programs of implementation to achieve standards. The triennial review provides the opportunity to review all water quality standards and identify portions of the Basin Plan that need to be updated or modified. Today, we will be conducting a public hearing for the triennial review of the Basin Plan and for the board to consider adoption of a resolution approving the triennial review of the San Francisco Bay Basin Water Quality Control Plan and adopting a prioritized list of planning projects. I want to introduce Dr. Martinez, Water Resource Control Engineer in the Planning Division, who will be providing the presentation on the triennial review process. I also want to acknowledge Javier Fernandez for his work, the entire team, Dr. Lundy, Richard Looker, and Yuri Wong, who is a dedicated team in working to prepare this extensive document and respond to all the comments. With that, Dr. Martinez, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Eileen. Good morning, Chair Hacker and members of the board. As Eileen said, my name is Gerardo Martinez. I'm a water resource control engineer in the planning division. And today I'm here to present the results of the triennial review of the San Francisco Bay Basin Plan, our region's master planning document. In my presentation, I'm going to briefly cover our basin plan, what a triennial review is, and why we do it. Then I will discuss the triennial review process. And lastly, I'm going to discuss our 5 high priority basin planning projects and our response to key public comments. Let's start out with some basics about the Water Quality Control Plan for the San Francisco Bay Basin, which we call the Basin Plan. The image on the right shows our region with a basin boundary highlighted in orange. It includes the San Francisco Bay, water sets that drain into the bay, and part of the Pacific Ocean. The basin plan is the basis for the Water Board's regulatory actions in this region. As you know, the basin plan contains beneficial uses of water bodies and water quality objectives to protect those water bodies, those uses, sorry. And I'll discuss these in more detail shortly. It also contains implementation programs to achieve our water quality objectives. The implementation program portion includes effluent limits, permit programs, discharge prohibitions, and our adopted total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs. The basin plan also serves as a valuable source of non-regulatory information about our region. Now, you may be asking, what is a triennial review of our basin plan, and why do we do it? Well, the Federal Clean Water Act requires us to review our water quality standards and hold a public hearing at least once every 3 years, while the California Water Code requires us to conduct a periodic review and revision of our basin plan. We also use this review to develop our work plan for our basin planning efforts. The review essentially comes down to asking ourselves and the public a couple of questions. First, we ask, do we need new or revised beneficial uses or water quality objectives? As part of this effort, we consider EPA's water quality criteria, recommended water quality criteria. Second, do we need new or revised implementation programs to achieve objectives to protect our designated uses? The triennial review ultimately results in a staff report available to the public that describes the review of our standards, all basin planning projects considered, and the list of prioritized projects. This is the core component of the documentation that we submit to EPA to communicate the results of our triennial review. I've mentioned the term water quality standards a couple of times, and this slide here helps us visualize the core components of a water quality standard under the Clean Water Act. Water quality standards are built on three essential parts, kind of like a three-legged stool. First, we have designated uses, or as we refer to these in California, beneficial uses. These describe what a specific water body is intended to support, like water contact recreation, such as swimming, or serving as a municipal drinking water source. Next, we have water quality criteria, or as we refer to these in California, water quality objectives. These are specific numeric or narrative limits that protect those uses that I just described. An example of a numeric limit in our region is dissolved oxygen, which needs to be above 5 mg/L to protect estuarine life in the bay. And finally, we have anti-degradation policies. These make sure existing high water quality is maintained and protected. As a reminder, when we are reviewing standards through the triennial review, we have an explicit obligation to review beneficial uses and objectives. And my next two slides will focus on those, the first two stools, I mean, first two legs of the stool. Ooh. Whoa. Okay, here we go. Sorry about that. For the first leg of the stool, I will discuss beneficial uses. As part of the triennial review, we assess whether existing beneficial uses need to be revised or if new ones should be adopted. In fact, one of our priority projects focuses on adding definitions for new tribal and subsistence fishing beneficial uses. The Clean Water Act also directs states to review the attainability of fishable, swimmable uses as part of the triennial review. For example, during this triennial review, we obtained new information about the attainability of commercial and sport fishing beneficial uses in lakes and reservoirs. If it turns out that these uses are attainable, then the state must revise the standards accordingly. Now I'm going to talk about the second leg of the stool related to water quality objectives. During a triennial review, we have an obligation to review the objectives in our basin plan, which includes site-specific objectives and region-wide objectives. We also have an obligation to consider if we need to adopt water quality objectives for priority toxic pollutants, for which EPA has recommended water quality criteria to protect both aquatic life and human health. These are referred to as 304A recommended criteria. However, it's important to note that these 304A recommended criteria are advisory and only become enforceable once a state adopts them. EPA provides that states retain discretion to develop their own criteria or make site-specific modifications to better reflect local conditions during the adoption process. Here is an overview of the triennial review process. First, we reviewed our basin plan to see if there were any revisions needed. Then, we developed an unranked list of candidate projects based on this review. Then, we got feedback from the public on the list of candidate projects and asked if there were any other projects that should be added, as well as support or opposition for the projects on the candidate list. With feedback from the public, then we created a ranked list of projects using the ranking criteria that I will discuss on the next slide. Then we published the ranked list of projects and a draft staff report for a 30-day public comment period. During this first comment period, we received 4 comment letters. We also received some late comments right before the triennial review hearing, which was scheduled for December 11th, 2024. We postponed the hearing so that we could address these comments and conduct additional analyses. We revised the staff report and included these additional analyses. We then published the revised staff report for a second 30-day public comment period, and we did not receive any additional comment letters during this period. At the end of my presentation, I will discuss our responses to key public comments. And now we are here at the final step on the green box for board consideration. We have limited staff resources for basin planning, and while every project on our list has merit, we don't have enough resources to complete all the projects on our candidate list over the next 3 years. Therefore, we must prioritize them to determine which projects we will work on. On this slide, you'll see the 10 criteria that were used to rank the projects during our recent triennial reviews. Each candidate project is scored against these criteria with a maximum possible score of 90 points. After scoring all of the candidate projects with the criteria that I just described, we ranked them from highest to lowest. As you can see, these are the 10 projects that were ranked. The top 5 highest projects are shown in green, while the 5 projects that didn't quite make it this year are shown in blue under the red dashed line. We also included each project's respective person year, or PY, shown in bold. One PY is equivalent to a full-time staff person for 1 year. And we have a total of 6 PY for the triennial review over the next 3 years. The PY for the priority projects in green totals 5.3 PY. And so the remaining 0.7 PY will be used for essential basin planning work, which includes attending to basin plan issues, coordinating with other regions and state board, and participating in the San Francisco Bay Regional Monitoring Program. I want to emphasize that the final ranking of a project is not a judgment about the merit of the project. Projects that receive low scores during this review may receive higher scores during other reviews due to changing circumstances. Now, I'm going to give you a quick tour through our 5 high-priority basin planning projects. The first project that ranked the highest was designating tribal and subsistence fishing beneficial uses. In 2017, the State Board adopted a resolution that defined 3 new beneficial uses: tribal tradition and culture, tribal subsistence, and subsistence fishing. However, State Board did not designate any of these uses for any water bodies in California. So like many other water boards and other regions, we plan on breaking this project up into 2 parts. Our first step is to add the definitions of these beneficial uses to our basin plan. And we can probably find an opportunity to piggyback this step onto another basin planning project. The work to designate the water bodies with these new beneficial uses will take more time because we need to work with community members so that their traditional ecological knowledge can meaningfully inform the designations. We've started building relationships with tribes and subsistence fishing communities to establish trust and rapport and ensure that the data we collect is meaningful and accurate. It's important to recognize that developing these relationships and building trust and partnerships will continue to take more time. Our second priority project is the Climate Change and Shoreline Adaptation Implementation Measures Project. For this project, we're going to focus on facilitating beneficial reuse of dredged sediment by reviewing the sediment screening process and potentially revising the section of Chapter 4 where we talk about dredging implementation. To accomplish this, we will need to work with our partner agencies in the long-term management strategy for the placement of dredged material in the San Francisco Bay region, commonly known as the LTMS. Our third priority project is Climate Change and Riparian Protection Implementation Measures Project. This project will emphasize the importance of protecting riparian corridors and ephemeral streams from climate-related water quality impacts. Specifically, we will add the information to the basin plan to explain the important role played by healthy riparian corridors and ephemeral streams in maintaining water quality, particularly in the face of a changing climate. We will also include implementation measures to promote resilience of these ecosystems to climate change effects. Our fourth priority project is developing a nutrient water quality attainment strategy for San Francisco Bay. As you know, and as Eileen mentioned earlier, the San Francisco Bay suffered a significant harmful algal bloom in the summer of 2022, resulting in massive fish kills. In response, you adopted an NPDES permit calling for a 40% nitrogen load reduction for municipal wastewater facilities. At the same time, you adopted a resolution directing staff to continue participating in the nutrient management strategy to make sure that we are collecting the information we need for our regulatory efforts. The resolution also directed staff to explore regulatory mechanisms to provide more time for compliance with the load reductions required by the permit for multi-benefit projects. This project is to carry out your instructions by articulating the regulatory strategy to reduce wastewater nutrient loads while providing an appropriate time frame for achieving these reductions. To complete this project, we expect this to take 1.5 PY over the next 3 years. However, this project is only funded for 1 PY over the next 3 years, so we are seeking additional funding to complete this project. Our fifth and final high priority project is the addition of commercial and sport fishing beneficial uses to lakes and reservoirs, or as we refer to this as COM. Our staff obtained new information, including the attainability of the COM beneficial use in 42 lakes and reservoirs in the San Francisco region, for which the COM use is not currently designated. This information consists of various forms of evidence that fishing is occurring in these water bodies. We intend to designate the COM beneficial use in these 42 lakes and reservoirs. As for future phases, we will continue to review new information that becomes available concerning the attainability of fishable swimmable uses in other water bodies. Now, I'm going to discuss the public comments that we received. These specific comments are from the first 30-day public comment period, which we received 4 comment letters. The first letter that we received was from Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, or BACWA. BACWA wrote to express disappointment regarding the final score for the Nutrient Water Quality Attainment Strategies project. And although we did not change the final score for the project, it remains a high priority and is currently ranked 4th. The second letter that we received was from San Francisco Baykeeper. Baykeeper wrote to urge us to delete the proposed Santa Clara Valley Water Recreation Standard Study. And while we did not delete this project, it ranked low and we are not prioritizing it.
We're on hold for 1 second to pull the presentation back
up. Yeah, we're going to slide 17.
The third letter we received was from Baykeeper and Clean Water Action. Together, they wrote to express support for the tribal and subsistence beneficial uses project, as well as the nutrient water quality attainment strategy project. They also asked that we should reopen the San Francisco Bay PCB TMDL, and we acknowledge that our staff do intend to work on revisiting the PCB TMDL. They also suggested that we create a new candidate project to update the basin's plan's selenium water quality objective, and they cited concerns about selenium toxicity to fish. We are not adding this project for several reasons. First, as we presented in the November board meeting, our existing North San Francisco Bay Selenium TMDL already protects bay fish, including the most sensitive species such as sturgeon and Sacramento splittail. Second, the new science they referenced does not support the toxicity concerns raised in their letter. More recent follow-up studies have not found deformities or high selenium concentrations in sensitive species of interest. Lastly, EPA is currently developing a new selenium criteria for San Francisco Bay and have asked us to hold off on any basin plan updates until that process is complete. The fourth and final letter that we received during this public comment period was from Clean Water Action and Baykeeper. And they wrote to urge that the designation of tribal and subsistence beneficial uses project is prioritized and implemented in a timely fashion. We agree with the commenters that this project is an important basin planning project as it was ranked first with a total of 66 points. Now I'm going to move on to this, these late letters that we received. So on November 23rd, November 26th, and December 9th, we received three late comment letters from Ecological Rights Foundation. ERF expressed four main concerns. First, ERF stated that we failed to re-examine water body segments that do not have fishable, swimmable, beneficial use designations. We took the opportunity to review information about the attainability of fishable, swimmable uses, and the scope of the resulting priority project has been expanded to reflect this analysis. This information can be found in Appendix C of the staff report, where we fulfill our obligations to evaluate fishable, swimmable uses. As shown in previous slides, we also have a candidate project to attend to these use designations, and this project is one of the five basin planning projects that we will pursue over the next 3 years. Secondly, ERF stated that we failed to consider or adopt water quality standards for priority toxic pollutants. We also took the opportunity to evaluate available EPA recommended criteria, especially in relation to our site-specific objectives in our basin plan. Through this analysis, we demonstrated that it is not necessary to adopt any 304A recommended criteria to replace our site-specific objectives. Our site-specific objectives are regionally more appropriate or protective due to water body conditions, local species toxicity results, or other site-specific factors. We are also deferring to the State Water Board to evaluate 304A criteria for statewide standards such as those in the EPA promulgated California Toxics Rule. The State Water Board will be reviewing these 304A criteria as part of its triennial review process that is occurring now. Thirdly, ERF stated that during the triennial review, we failed to adopt water quality standards found to be appropriate. We have a fundamentally different reading of the relevant regulations in terms of the allowable time frame for adoption of water quality standards, even if they are found to be appropriate. We assert that we have met our legal obligations to revise water quality standards. And lastly, ERF stated that we failed to submit the results of the triennial review to EPA. We disagree that the Regional Water Board has never reported on the results of its triennial review. We send the results of our triennial review to EPA by sending the board resolution on the triennial review and its results, as well as the supporting staff report, the list of priority projects resulting from the review of all water quality standards, and public participation records. EPA has always accepted the Regional Water Board's submittals. In summary, we fulfilled our triennial review responsibilities by conducting a comprehensive review of all applicable water quality standards, as well as the implementation programs in the basin plan. Based on this review, we identified a set of priority basin planning projects that you heard today, and now we are happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Gerardo. Once the lights are up, I'll look to board members for questions and comments. Who'd like to start? Bill?
Thank you for that presentation. That was really helpful. How does this report square with prior triennial reviews? Are these projects that are identified as high priorities sort of one and done? I mean, obviously, these are very ambitious objectives, which we're not going to get done in 3 years. So how does this compare to prior triennial reviews? How does this differ from prior triennial reviews? I had a hard time in reading the report seeing what the connection was to prior reports, if any.
Yeah, that's a good question. So from the 2021 triennial review, it also, I wasn't here, but we had another set of high priority basin planning projects. And some of those, two of those continue to be priority projects that were not completed. So for example, the subsistence and beneficial uses project, that remains to be a high priority project, which was not completed. There were some steps that were completed, and now we are continuing on. But there were other projects that were completed, specifically for the nutrient water quality attainment strategy project. One part of that project was completed, and now we are moving on to the second phase of that. Another project that we completed was another climate change related project. And I think if Javier, if you want to.
Yeah, we completed, as you guys are aware, you adopted the basin plan amendment for climate change and shoreline protection that was non-regulatory to add information to the basin plan. So that's another one. This is the next phase. The new climate change of shoreline is actually looking at doing a basin plan amendment potentially that would actually be regulatory to facilitate beneficial reuse.
Maybe it's in there. I just didn't see it when I was reading the report, but it might be useful to provide some historical context and explain, you know, exactly what you just said, Javier, on specific projects, so for future. But it's very, very interesting.
Yeah, actually, kind of in the vein of Bill, I was just wondering, are the 10 projects that are listed part of the adoption process, meaning the top five obviously a priority, but in the current economic climate or whatever may be happening, do you guys need flexibility to potentially tap into the other projects, or are they just kind of, they will not be addressed at all until the next 3-year review? More of a construction type question, Eileen, I know.
So generally, they will not be touched over the next 3 years. However, if we are able to get additional resources, there are times where we will take on additional projects as we can. As you mentioned, given the current resource limitations and not really looking like in the next 3 years we're going to get a lot of additional resources, I would speculate that we're not going to do much on the other five.
Actually, it kind of prompts a question in my mind. Do we, I mean, obviously this is a public document, the world can see it, but do we ever let permittees know, hey, you know, a possible way of mitigation, possible opportunity is to help us fund this particular project, which, you know, fell below the line in our scoring?
Yes. In fact, we got legislation passed. Keith was and Tom did a great job leading this legislation that allows agencies now to fund positions if they want a project prioritized. So, yeah, special kudos to Tom and Keith on that.
Thank you for this. I really appreciate the systematic way this work is done. I mean, you have to kind of turn the grinder. There's sort of no way around it. So I noticed that I have two questions for you. First, commenters were commenting on the list of projects but not commenting on the criteria that we use to score them. Is that correct? So that there's general agreement with the criteria that we use to score things?
Yeah, I think that there's a general agreement on the criteria, and we have used this in past triennial reviews. So
good. Okay.
It's also in our staff report, and people know that that is the ranking criteria. Mm-hmm. When we post the initial document, we have a document that's posted with the ranking criteria that describes each ranking criteria and like what constitutes a 20 for waterboard mission versus what would be a 10 or what would be a 0.
Right, and that's, we've been pretty consistent with those criteria and people are willing to kind of abide by those.
Yeah, we did not receive any comments on the ranking criteria. We do have a section on when we post it to the public that says any other additional comments that you may have, and we did not receive any comments on the criteria.
My second question has to do with designating commercial fishery uses. Once we do that, does that then either require action or anything by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, or are there other things that get kicked over because we identify that this is something that's happening?
I'll take that one. That's a good question, Andy. I'd say in general, the biggest change that would occur from designating COM would be a clear indication of how to analyze existing fish data to know whether fish are safe to eat. But in general, in our integrated report and 303D list assessment, we're already using standard metrics, even if the COM beneficial use is not designated for a lake or water body and we have fish data, we've been using the same data in practice in that venue. So that would be the one thing, be very clear to use which criteria should be used when that COM beneficial use is formally designated. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any other action from CDFW.
Yeah, I have a few more comments than questions, probably. Thank you for a very thoughtful piece of work. I want to first say, been on this board, I think, 8 years, and to see how much priority has been put on climate-related actions is really great to see. So thank you, and I'm glad to see it continuing. Second comment was I was really struck by the everybody around the world has to prioritize their workload. And at some point, maybe later this year, I'd love to hear how we're thinking about AI and how that is changing in all fields the ability to do more with less and to do it faster. I'm seeing it in many facets of my work. You know, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. I forget who said that, but so maybe that's something that we can talk about later this year because it really is on top of us. Do you want to?
Yeah, and I'd be happy to In fact, at the management meeting MCC on Monday, there was a presentation about how the Water Board could potentially be using AI for efficiencies. So it's something evolving, but I'm really pleased to see that the state board and regional boards are really looking at those opportunities. So it might be later in the year, but definitely it's something that we're following.
That's
so
great.
Thank you.
That's great. And then my last comment is one that is just makes me sad to even say, but I have a pretty good drive from Half Moon Bay to here when I come to these meetings, so I get to listen to a lot of NPR. And there was a big story this morning about USEPA and the pullback of grants, including grants throughout California that had been previously designated and have been, they're not going to happen. They've been canceled. No longer priority. So I know that the alignment with USEPA policies is part of the criteria. I noted that, and I just would say things are changing rapidly and in unexpected ways. So I just hope that we'll keep an eye on that. And we're lucky to be in California. We have lots of state laws and protections, but I'm concerned. I think we've got to be concerned about that alignment. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the work you're doing in this area. I know for so many years, this has been such a starkly underfunded part of the whole portfolio, and yet it is also the foundation of this regulatory house. And so it's so ironic to me that from my time at USEPA, realizing how few resources were available in the regional boards and at EPA, not only to develop new standards and get them through the process. We can all look at how long the toxicity requirements took, almost two decades, and here we are. So I appreciate that you have looked meticulously at what is the art of the possible and made these choices, which I support. I have an ongoing interest in hearing back how the state board's triennial review process is playing out, and specifically which of the 304A criteria they're considering, and any appropriate way of feeding that information back to us will help just elevate our shared knowledge on this. It's tough to do when there's so few PY in this part. I was intrigued in preparing for the meeting in looking at Appendix A and all the materials you gave us, the editorial revisions, minor clarifications and corrections that you start to list on A3 and thereafter. It's so tempting, and I'm hopeful that you can spare a wee bit of time in the PY allocation to bring those updates, editorial and otherwise, into the document. I sympathize with the BACWA comment of wanting this to be a searchable document. I understand that we don't have the resources to do that, but if we could understand what it would take to make it a searchable document, it would be helpful to understand that a bit better. But meanwhile, what you've listed there across A3, 4, and 5 are all such worthwhile editorial changes to building this and making it current that I encourage us to be able to do that, and I would be keen a year hence to have an informational item on how this is all playing out. I think that with triennial review, water quality objectives, and beneficial uses, the whole board benefits from hearing about it every year, not just every 3 years. So if you have the wherewithal to give us an update in a year's time, that would be terrific. Are there any further questions or comments? Board Member Ransom, anything to add?
Not at this point. Thank you.
Okay. Well, with that, if there are no further, Julie, are there
Chair.
Public registrations of people who may wish to come? Or let me turn to Yuri, please.
That's exactly what I was going to talk about. So you beat me to the punch.
All right. I have notes here. Okay. Do we have public registrations?
We have no online registrations.
Do we have anyone in the room who wishes to comment on this fabulous topic? With such great staff. All right. Eileen, would you like to offer a recommendation with regard to this?
Yes. We recommend the board adopt the resolution approving the triennial review of the San Francisco Bay Basin Water Quality Control Plan and adopt the list of prioritized basin planning projects.
Thank you, Eileen. May I ask the board for a motion and a second?
Moved. So moved.
Second.
It was moved by Board Member Beelen and seconded by Board Member Batty. Julie, would you please call the vote?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Beelen.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Young.
Aye.
And Chair Hacker.
Aye. Thank you. The resolution approving the triennial review of the San Francisco Bay Basin Water Quality Control Plan and the adoption of the list of prioritized basin planning projects for shoreline climate change resilience planning has been adopted by the board. Thank you to the team for their continued hard work in this area. For those who may wish to take a moment's break, let's take a moment to just stand up, and then we will move on to the next informational item with regard to Hunter's Point. If folks would take their seats, we're going to start in a minute. David, are we good to go? Dakota? Yeah? Welcome. All right. Let's resume. Eileen, please proceed with the next item.
Sure. Thank you. So this next informational item is an opportunity to hear from the United States Department of the Navy and U.S. EPA about the cleanup progress of the former Hunters Point Naval Shipyard in San Francisco. This item is a follow-up to the staff report in the September 2024 Executive Officers Report and was requested by the board. The Navy is the lead agency responsible for investigation and cleanup of the site, and U.S. EPA is the lead federal regulatory agency, and the Department of Toxic Substance Control and the Regional Board are the lead state regulatory agency. To give you perspective, U.S. EPA listed the site on the National's Priorities List in 1989, and the base was closed in 1991. In 1992, the Regional Water Board entered into a federal facilities agreement with the Navy, U.S. EPA, and the Department of Toxic Substances Control to establish a framework and schedule for regulatory oversight. A lot of work has been accomplished over the last couple decades. These sites are very complex, and I'm very happy to introduce you today, Danella Janda. She's the Navy's base closure manager for the former Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. She's going to provide an update on the cleanup progress and what's ahead as the Navy works to prepare the site for transfer to the City of San Francisco for redevelopment. Then we're going to hear from Mike Montgomery, the Director of Superfund and Emergency Management Division at U.S. EPA Region 9, and he's going to share the federal regulatory perspective on the cleanup progress and the path forward towards successful cleanup of the site for reuse. And I do want to acknowledge our team, Jessica Watkins. We've got Mary Snow. We've got Nathan and Selena Hernandez, who've all been working on this site for many years. So just wanted to recognize everybody. And with that.
Good morning, everyone. Before Danielle goes into the presentation, I just wanted to introduce myself and just give a few seconds about our organization and what we do, just to give some perspective. My name's Tony Megliola. I'm the director of the BRAC Program Management Office. We're located in San Diego, just down the road. We also have offices on the East Coast and in Washington, D.C., and a small caretaker site office up out of the Treasure Island location. But again, we're called BRAC PMO. I'm responsible for the West Coast. We're part of the Naval Facilities Engineering Systems Command, and we are responsible for BRAC implementation, but we do not develop or recommend any bases or basis for closure or realignment. That's done through the congressional process and hasn't been done in quite a long time, as you know. But as Eileen mentioned, these projects are long and complex. We currently have we currently have a portfolio of 43 former installations. 16 of those have some remaining property. It could be 50 acres, or it could be 2,000, like in the case of Concord, and everything in between. And we have 27 installations where 100% of the property has been transferred, but we still have ongoing environmental actions. So what we do, as I mentioned before, we implement the base closure commission recommendations. There's been 5 rounds of base closure, 88, 91, 93, 95, and 2005. So what does this mean? It involves oversight of the realignment and closure actions for the Navy. We liaison with the community and with stakeholders. We manage the environmental work required for property transfer. We perform caretaker functions on closed installations. We are responsible for the financial management of the Department of the Navy base realignment and closure funds. And we support and provide political and congressional interface. We work closely with DOD, Department of Defense, and the Department of the Navy Secretariat staff, federal, state, local political leaders, local redevelopment authorities, federal and state agencies, property recipients and developers, and local community groups, as well as the general public. So that I just wanted to provide that as a general overview before Danielle gets into the specifics on Hunter's Point. So thank you.
Thank you for coming to join us today. Welcome, Danielle.
Thank you. Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm Danielle Janda. I'm the base closure manager for Hunter's Point, so I'm responsible for overseeing the closure of the base and eventual transfer to the City of San Francisco. So I'm going to talk a little bit today, just give an overview of Hunter's Point, why we're here, all the work that we've done so far, and all the work that we need to continue to do. So go to the next slide, please. Oh. Okay. Oh, great. All right, just some background. Eileen already talked about this. We've been on the NPL list since 1989. Hunter's Point was closed as part of the base realignment and closure program in 1991. Since then, we've been doing our environmental restoration program under CERCLA. We did transfer the old housing area, that's called Parcel A, to the City of San Francisco. It's since been developed, and they're still working on development in those areas. We've signed 11 records of decision, so that defines the cleanup that we have to do, and our very last one was signed last year, last September. And just some framework for, as Eileen said, we entered a federal facilities agreement, so this establishes our regulatory framework and a collaborative process. So that's with the Navy, Environmental Protection Agency, DTSC, and Regional Water Quality Control Board. So I just put this up to show, the number of engagements that we do. It's a very collaborative project. We try to meet at least monthly in our BRAC cleanup teams. We've entered formal partnering with the EPA and DTSC, and also California Department of Public Health is heavily involved with that. So we meet 4 times a year, 2 days. We dedicate that time to talking about highlighting issues that all agencies may have. We have 2, we call them executive steering group meetings. So there's, because Hunter's Point is such a major project for all our agencies, we have executive level meetings every 6 months. And then we also, there's a heavy amount of community engagement. So all these agencies work together on, we call it the COWG, so Community Outreach Working Group, on best ways to engage with the community. So in general, just an overview of our cleanup program. It's divided into parcels, so that's to aid in the cleanup process and the transfer process. So you can see the map in the middle shows all the parcels are divided. Each one has its own record of decision, it has its own cleanup plan, but in general, the cleanup is a combination of excavation of contaminated soil, in-situ remediation of groundwater, soil gas assessments, and containment, either by building a shoreline, putting on durable covers, and various items like that. We also have land use controls as a key aspect of our remediation to make sure that future use is aligned with our remedial action. So it's a big program. We spent $1.3 billion to date on this cleanup, and we have done a lot of work on the base so far. So this is just some stats to show what we have accomplished, although it does not cover everything. As I said, we did transfer a few parcels. So the cleanup was complete in a few of those. We signed 11 records of decision. We removed 28 miles of sewer lines. Removed 1.5 million cubic yards of contaminated soil, treated $8.6 million gallons of groundwater. We've closed 62 petroleum sites. We've been working on radiological rework over the past few years. We've collected at least 70,000 samples to verify the status of the site. We installed 2 miles of engineered shoreline and installed 240 acres of what we call durable cover. So it's asphalt across the base, and that's regularly maintained. Highlighting some of our bigger projects over the last year or so. Last year, we demolished a building. It's called Building 123. So there's contaminated soil underneath the building that we're getting ready to excavate very shortly. So last year, we tore the building down so we could get to that soil. We've also been, as I said, doing radiological rework over the past few years. So that second picture shows basically redigging all the trenches where all those sewer lines were removed. We installed 2,000 feet of shoreline revetment at one of the parcels. We began characterizing a deep fractured water bearing zone. So we're installing wells that are 70 feet deep to see if contamination has migrated down into the deep fractured water bearing zone. As I said, we signed our last record of decision last year, and EPA set up a signing ceremony, so we got to talk about it with the community. And we finalized our plan for the, we have a slurry wall in parcel E2, which is our landfill. So we finalized the plan and can go do that investigation this year. So those are some of our accomplishments. It's not everything. But I did want to highlight, you know, we're out there every day doing work constantly. And they're big projects. So we have a lot of environmental controls in place to protect human health and the environment. So these are just some of them. Protect the bay using best management practices for stormwater. So we have swale screens, street sweeping. We make sure all the dust stays on Hunter's Point. We have a truck wash station before they go off site. Stockpile management. We also have a pretty extensive biomonitoring program to protect protected species. We do extensive air monitoring. We collect both dust monitoring and we analyze it for contaminants of concern. We make sure all our trucks are covered. We do radiological scans. We make sure our radiological sites are in protected areas. And then we have health and safety plans to make sure that the workers remain safe during the work. We have a pretty robust community engagement. Michael Pound is our BRAC environmental coordinator. He's been reaching out to as many groups as he can to get our information out there and create some engagement. We do a minimum of 6 community advisory committee meetings. All the agencies participate. I know Ms. Snow from the Water Board has been very helpful getting their position out there, and I think it's really appreciative for us to be in front of the, just be there to listen to people. We do bus tours. I mentioned the signing ceremony. We have an independent radiological expert available in case somebody wants to go to somebody that is not with the Navy. And then we've teamed up with some groups. So last year, for example, Michael gave a tour for Young Community Developers. It's a group that trains young people in the community for potential jobs. So we gave them a tour of one of our construction sites. This is some examples of what we do. So it's a big program. Of course, it comes with its challenges. It's a very large, complex cleanup site. In a lot of cases, we have very extremely low cleanup levels. It can be very difficult sometimes just to differentiate between background and our cleanup and our contamination. I just put this picture on the right to kind of demonstrate how low our radiological goals are compared to other screening levels. Last year we finished a two-year study to find a new laboratory method because our remedial goal was so low that the standard laboratory method was not able to detect it accurately. So there's just an example of like what one of the challenges that we're dealing with. We have a lot of stakeholders. So we, even just with the FFA, we have four agencies. There's other state agencies we work with, California Department of Public Health. We work with the Air Board. And then we work very closely with the City of San Francisco, so the Office of Community Investment and Infrastructure, along with San Francisco Department of Public Health. We work with the developer who has investment in the property. And, of course, the community is very active, and they're diverse in and of themselves. So there's lots of different community groups, and they all have different interests. And with all those stakeholders, communication, you know, understanding everybody's point of view, that can be very challenging. You know, we tried to put in place a robust collaboration with all the agencies. I think formal partnering with EPA and DTSC has really helped us highlight some issues and get through some tough issues, bring it to the attention, get some attention on it to get them resolved quicker so we're not sitting fighting about policy, instead moving forward and actually putting shovels in the ground. Of course, we all know we all have a finite amount of funding, you know, so that affects how many projects we can do, so we have to figure out which projects to prioritize funding on. We have had, over the past couple years, through partnering, we've been talking about California's radiological regulations, which conflict with the Navy policy and federal regulations, and so that's created some difficulty kind of getting to the finish line with our radiological projects. PFAS is an emerging contaminant, so it wasn't considered in all our records of decision. So that's a challenge, is coming, adding this late in the game. We do have very complex geology. Hunter's Point was built over time, so we have the old site with bedrock, and then we have the dredge fill on top and bay mud, and it can be quite complex. Of course, radiological rework, I didn't talk too much about it, but most people know that there was fraud with our old radiological work at Hunter's Point, so we have to dedicate a large amount of our time and resources on redoing that work. And as I said, the community is very engaged, and so communicating the very complex science to the community can be challenging because environmental data there's a lot of environmental data, and it can be very difficult to understand. And so that's why we have that big community outreach plan. Also, schedules, you know, are always difficult. We have weather delays. We have, again, multiple stakeholders, multiple agencies trying to get work plans, documents approved, things like that. It can be very challenging to keep to, you know, everybody wants an exact schedule, but that can be very challenging, especially in the environmental world where we're driven by the science. So the schedules depend on what we find in the field as well. So I talked a little bit about how much work we have done. We still have a lot to go. So as I said, we've spent $1.3 billion. We're estimating about $1.2 to finish our work. So this is just showing all the work that we have planned for next year. We're working on every single parcel. It's a variety of field work, reports. And these are some... Oh, sorry. And these are some bigger projects just to highlight that are going on. We started investigating the deep fractured water bearing zone. We're going to do a second phase of that. So some more 70-foot wells are going to be installed. We have two big excavations coming out this year. We're going to remove about 5,000 cubic yards of soil underneath that building that I mentioned we tore down. And then we have about 2,000 cubic yards in another parcel that we plan to excavate this coming year. Okay, I don't know why this is not cooperating, sorry. Okay, these are our timeline milestones. We just published our annual FFA schedule, so that's what the cleanup dates are based off of. As I said, that's all dependent on a variety of factors. But what we're currently projecting is that the cleanup program will be complete from the first parcel G and E2, in 2028, going all the way to 2036. So these are really important milestones for us and for the BRAC program, and also for the city of San Francisco, because we cannot start on the transfer process until we get to this completion stage. And so this is what the future plans of Hunters Point are. I borrowed this slide from the Office of Community Investment and Infrastructure with the City of San Francisco. This shows their proposed land use. Our cleanup is compatible with this land use, with their land use plan, so we work with them very closely to make sure that what we're doing is going to allow them to develop the property the way their plans have worked out. And as you can see, the right are some stats that they provided. It's a really important project to the city of San Francisco. It's supposed to provide a large amount of public benefits, a lot of and a lot of housing. So we're very keyed into particularly the next developable parcel, which is parcel G, and that's what this timeline is showing. So this is our we call it critical milestones. Parcel G is the furthest along in the process. We only have three more projects left. As I said, PFAS, we have soil rework, and we're demolishing some buildings. So this is meant to just so everybody's very clear on what the current milestones are and what we're working towards. Okay. That's all I was gonna. Have today. This is, like I said, Michael Pound is our BRAC environmental coordinator. He's our primary resource for the community. There's his information. We also have some other resources. Dr. Kathy Higley, she is our radiological independent expert. So if somebody wants to talk about radiological issues but they don't want to talk to us, she's available. She also does monthly office hours, and we have our website, and we also have an info hotline. And that's it. This is a rendering that, again, I borrowed from the city of San Francisco. Just thought I'd end on showing what we're kind of working towards. So this is what they picture the dry dock to look like. I just like to be reminded on kind of what we're working towards and why we're here. That's all I had. Thank you for letting me talk about the project. It's an important project to me and to the Navy. And thank you for showing interest.
Danielle, thank you for joining us. Please feel free to sit up front, and we'll turn to EPA's Superfund Director, Mike Montgomery. Welcome, Mike.
All right. Yeah. Either way, what do you prefer? I'll just be from here. Sorry, my apologies for being late. It's wonderful to be here. Nice to see all of the board again after many years. Being away. Apologize for being late. I had to surrender some nail clippers outside to the security officials. I'd never had to do that before because I always had a badge and didn't have to do that. Didn't realize it was as rigorous a test as expected. I want to... You never know. I want to thank the Executive Officer, Eileen White, for having done the informational item that led to the interest from the board to hear about this project. It's a challenging project. You know, we've got 113 Superfund sites at Region 9 and EPA, and I can easily say that this is probably one of the 10 most difficult ones. But it's difficult for different reasons, like most sites. And I think there's a common misperception that cleanup hasn't occurred or that cleanup is not happening. And I think there has been a lot of cleanup. There are elements of those cleanups that we're, in fact, kind of cleaning up, right? Because you don't always get a remedy right the first time you put it into place. It's, colleagues from the Navy mentioned, it's complex, you know, some complex geology. It's near-shore environments. It's somewhat complicated. I would say the thing... And I had listened in during the last informational session, so I have a little bit of an idea as to maybe some of the questions you all have. So I'll just dive in on some. You know, one of the things that has caused a significant delay in the cleanup and transfer of the property is the radiological retesting. And just coming up with an appropriate statistical methodology to confirm that, in fact, the cleanup that had been done occurred and wasn't flawed due to the fraudulent activity of the contractor was a very difficult task in and of itself. Implementing has proven to be a very difficult task because testing for radiological contamination down to what is effectively very close to background levels can be very complicated from a laboratory lab methodology standpoint. And so we'd run into questions about data that was showing up that didn't look like it was good data, and having to work with the Navy and our national radiological experts to modify the methods for certain radiological contaminant types. There's a pretty constant amount of litigation that the Navy and EPA is subject to by parties at the site. And that litigation is associated with some very large FOIA requests, so we've had to spend a lot of hours on records, a lot of hours on defending agency decisions and state decisions since we signed those rods together. And that's created a very, difficult environment. People are very cautious, and one of the things that happened early on, I'll admit, is sort of everybody kind of pulled back from the community because of all the litigation that was happening. And I think I'm really proud in the last couple of years, we've really leaned back into engaging the community. The Water Board was very helpful about a year and a half ago. We had a workshop down in the community on shoreline resilience. A lot of good things came out of that. One of the things that we've been sued on is that the delay in the five-year review. One of the reasons it was delayed was we had a lot of really good comments. The Navy did an excellent job, but there's a lot of things that we, the Water Board and EPA, wanted them to look more closely at. We were able to negotiate a resolution of those differences, and now they're on a path to doing that work, and that work is on schedule. I think the only challenge that we face is potential changes in funding levels that the Navy's going to have in doing that follow-up work to the five-year review. And as you all remember, sort of five-year reviews are check-ins on remedies that are in place to see if they're working. And sometimes when you say, well, hey, this isn't working as it was designed, it may be working 90%. It may be working 80%. That's still a reduction of risk. That's still protection of human health and the environment. But you need to try and get that last 10%. Or if you can't get it, then you just come to terms with that fact. So, I'll stop there. I think Navy's got an excellent website. We're actually going to be putting up a storyboard, which is a new method that we use to communicate with the public. We've used it on our fire response work that really provides a very visually interesting tool for the community to learn about what's happened at a site. And that's all I had to share. I hope that wasn't too much information.
No, and thank you. Those of you here know that Eileen's predecessor is Mike Montgomery, and I imagine you think back fondly on your time in this.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think a lot of fond memories, a lot of kind of frankly humorous memories, including the day that the sky went totally dark and we had to have that, or the day that the power in the building went out and we had to reschedule. So we've had, you know, we had a lot of pretty interesting 3 years for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let me turn to board member comments and questions. I can start with Bill.
Sure. Yeah, I have a few questions. Nice to see you, Mike, and thanks for the presentation, Ms. Chanda. You know, schedule, I think, is the thing that really stands out in my mind. And so let me just start with a couple small questions. So Parcel A was transferred in 2004. What's happened there since then?
They've built on a large part of it. So there are some condos up in Parcel A right now.
And has its development been impeded by the work that's being done on the other parcels, or it truly is underway?
There's no environmental reason to impede those parcels. There may be financial reasons, but there's no environmental reasons.
Do you have any sense of what the number of units that are that have been built there in that time?
On Parcel A? I don't. We can get that to you all.
Yeah.
We can get that to you all. It's a pretty good-sized development.
Yeah.
It was pretty quickly, it went to market well. It sold well. The residents have a homeowners association. We engage with them. They're interested in issues. There was a brief stint during the development of those parcels where there were some concerns. There's a lot of serpentine rock out there, and anytime you get into dirt, earth moving, you have asbestos monitors, and there were some, again, kind of issues at that time that EPA worked on with the city of San Francisco to make sure that their asbestos air monitoring was adequate for the earthwork that was happening.
Yeah. I mean, I take, Ms. Andrew, your points about the complexity of the site, but the length of time is just breathtaking, you know, where you've got a site that was put on the NPL, you know, literally, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It's sort of astounding. And I guess the question is, the next site out there that's to be transferred is Unit G, 3 years from now. To what extent is that unit going to be rich in residential units? I mean, there's study after study about California being profoundly limited in its ability to accommodate new population because of housing costs, because of the shortage of housing. Here you've got hundreds of acres that could be redeployed to that purpose, and obviously those are the plans. You know, the 3,000, you know, 3,500 units that are contemplated for there are just critical to San Francisco's and the Bay Area's economic viability in the future in terms of housing costs. To what extent is Unit G going to contribute to that? That's 3 years from now that it can be developed, at least under the current schedule. To what extent does it meaningfully contribute to that?
So I can't speak for the OCII is in charge of the development, and I can't really speak to what their plans are. I know one of the reasons that we focused on Parcel G was because it was supposed to be, this was years ago, it was supposed to be the first parcel that brought commercial services, right? So they built all the condos in Parcel A, and their complaints, reasonably, is like, we thought we were going to be here and we were going to get to go down to these services, stores, jobs, whatever, and that hasn't materialized. So that's one of the reasons why we're focused on G. Now, whether or not the city has changed their plans or what they plan to do with it, I can't speak to that.
I mean, the fraud in and of itself has cost this project at least a decade. And I don't know if you would have a different opinion on that timing, but that's just my rough guess. And Parcel G is the first parcel that will have successfully completed the radiological retesting program. And that'll be significant. The Navy's also concurrently working on B and C, which are significant parcels within that core, and on the utility corridors. So we're hopeful that we'll see a series of transfers, and completion of this radiological retesting program over the next 3 to 5 years.
Mike, you mentioned litigation. That's slowed things down. Obviously, there's fraud on the radiological studies. You mentioned it slowed everything down. Is there any way to the extent there's still pending litigation on any of these cases, to resolve these cases by way of a settlement that expedites, speeds up the issue? I mean, you mentioned that funding is an issue. Is there a way to accelerate the funding to get this work done more quickly? I mean, what I'm hearing is the completion of this project to really get the residential units that are so desperately in need in place. We're looking at another 10 years before it really gets done. Is there any way to speed that up?
Our work is not really affected by litigation. First of all, they're kind of two separate tracks. I think, you know, Mike is right that the fraud has put us back decades. But if you look at, you know, what the projects we have, it's also as the cleanup takes longer, the environmental industry changes, right? So PFAS became a hazardous substance last year. So if the fraud hadn't have happened, we would have transferred that already, and they would have started their development. But now, because we've had it for so long, we can't transfer it without treating PFAS. So if you actually look at the figure I showed, PFAS is the holdup right now, not radiological rework. And then, you know, I mentioned that the radiological regulations in California have been very difficult. And we have we've embarked on demolishing the buildings, and so these things have changed, and that has to be accounted for. So the longer the cleanup takes, the more change we have to account for.
Another reason to speed it up.
Yeah.
Regulations are becoming more and more stringent.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Thanks. I don't have any answers. I wish there were simple answers. It's frustrating how long it takes.
Yeah. Anthony.
Yeah, I was wanted to ask about the 2 miles of revetments that were installed. So we're building towards a future, and the future looks different now than it did in 1990. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you have been able or not been able to incorporate, you mentioned shoreline resilience in the community effort, but in terms of thinking about the impact of sea level rise on the project and its resilience over time.
Mm-hmm. So when the records of decisions were all signed in the 2000s, and then the designs were done, and the designs did account for changing climate and changing sea level rise, but of course those projections are changing, right? So as part of the 5-year review last year, we did an assessment, and it's going to be an ongoing analysis. Right now we're working on a groundwater modeling to look at natural hazards and how it may affect our remedies, because the Navy is going to be in charge of these remedies in perpetuity, right? So if they don't work in 20 years, we're going to be responsible for that. So we are looking at it, but it is going to take time, right? We have our groundwater model, and then we have some site-specific studies that we're going to look at, and if we have to make changes to the remedy, that's what we'll have to do.
I'm all about following the money these days. So if I heard you right, $1.3 billion or so spent, another $1.2 or so to go. What's your, either of you, what's your crystal ball on allocations and funding? And is it secured or is it not? Or can you talk to us about that?
Well, we do a funding process where we request funds. Hunters Point has relied heavily on congressional plus-ups for that $1.3 billion. So, you know, Ms. Pelosi has been a very good resource for us. So we don't know how that's going to change in the future.
When what's the timeline on that? Like, when do you know annually, like, what that looks like?
The
Do you want to answer?
It's an annual appropriation, and the fiscal year starts 1 October, but typically we don't actually get the appropriation until sometime later in the year. Each year is different. This year we appear to be in a continuing resolution for the entire year, and so we're getting it in four separate tranches. So that's what's going on now, and the future is relatively unknown.
Great. I guess I would just ask, as we know, it'd be great to get updates on how things are looking.
Sure. I can continue to provide updates to the board, and our staff continues, besides the stop right now, work order, but they continue to work collaboratively to try to get to that dream picture that Danelle showed in her last slide that, you know, at least we're all working towards a common goal. But as you can see, there's challenges both with state funding, federal funding, but we all share a common vision.
What would you say for the balance of 2025 are the most notable one or two actions that the board would be wise to learn more about?
Well, I talked about the projects coming up. We are doing some, we're continuing investigation of that deep fractured water bearing zone that I know the Water Board has been very, you know, very collaborative in developing the plan for that. There are those two excavations. Those are to treat soil that one is a VOC pathway, so to treat those. So I would think those are the major actions coming up.
And for the contaminated soil that's moved off-site to commercial, does it tend to go to one of the two in-state or out-of-state commercial disposal options?
It all depends on the type of waste. In general, I think we use California landfills, but it depends on how the brokers characterize the waste and what's frankly cheapest for the contractors. Our upcoming building demolition, we are going to dispose of all of our non-hazardous waste outside of California because we cannot get clearance within California, and we would have to dispose of it as hazardous waste, and that's incredibly expensive, partially because of the California taxes on it. So it's actually cheaper for us to bring that out of state, and we'll potentially recycle it there.
Thank you. Any final comments that you'd like to make on behalf of the Navy?
Thank you for allowing us to be here today to explain the Hunter's Point project. We really appreciate it.
And Mike, on behalf of the feds?
No, we just really value our partnership with the Water Board. It's always a pleasure I don't get to meet with them as often, but when we do have meetings, these higher level meetings that we've established with the Navy and the state to try and quickly resolve issues, it's always great to hear about the progress that's been made. So thank you for the opportunity to come over.
Thanks to each of you. Let me ask our board clerk if we have anyone registered to speak.
No online registrations.
Is there anyone present here today that wishes to comment on this item? Seeing none, thank you.
Mark
and thank
Ransom.
You, Eileen and Jessica, for...
Chair. Mark Ransom also had his hand up.
Welcome.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Linda Fadiki Richardson, and I'm here today. I was just here just to listen. It's my first time at your meeting, but I'm very impressed. I'm wearing many hats. Longtime resident of Baby Hunters Point. And contrary to what people think about Baby Hunters Point, for the last decades, we actually are actively involved. And I've read almost all documents, technical, since decades now, and actively involved. I'm also affiliated with the Citizen Advisory Board. Dr. Veronica Hanneke is the chair. And they facilitate all the meetings. And we also have San Francisco Agency DOCII, which I know you had questions before. They are religiously, if I can use the word, you know, attentive to the community needs and provide the guidance, you know, to. So there is a high interest because, as Danielle mentioned before, and the EPA is that the Hunters Point development is actually the largest project to that San Francisco is looking at to revitalize that community. And when you look at, as one of your commissioners mentioned before, questions about residential, when you look at the regional housing allocation, where actually San Francisco is looking at the Hunters Point to fulfill those requirements. So this project for decades and $1.3 billion, you can really look at the implications here. There are two issues on the community of, you know, plate. And again, we appreciate your agency. You know, Mary Snow, her team are constantly asking the pertinent questions that the community will support them. And I want to acknowledge that today when it comes to mercury, you know, contamination, you know, what, again, where are we going to that? That is an action on your five-year review. There is this conversation going on between the EPA and the Navy to try to get to the measurement, to you know, resolve that, because what is currently is not working, and how are we going to move forward because the contamination. So Mary Snow and her team has been on that, and the community appreciate that. And we appreciate also, you know, Danielle, of recent, there are $1.3 billion spent, and the community is asking, no, can you, are there opportunity for us to be part of the cleanup, because the shipyard is supposed to be the economic engine. And so Danielle, right now, NAVAC have come up with, and we are monitoring that, to allow the community to participate in the cleanup. And so this is something that the public is on the radar, you know, and we will know with the agreement that was made how that is going to work out, so that is on the plate of the community right now. With regards to the EPA, we were disheartened when Andrew Bain, you know, is no longer, Mr. Bain has been, I need to stay here, a stellar employee of the EPA. There are issues with community trust, but we think right now with the composition, with the OCI helping, and also with the San Francisco regulatory agencies and the state, and working to oversee what the Navy is doing, that maybe we might be able to get to something here and rebuild the community trust. But so thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today, and thank you for your leadership and your work in trying to help us. Please be on that. Put this on your radar. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to speak in person and for your engagement in the long-term process here. It was nice to have you recognize one of Mike's former staff, Andy Bain. And if there are any closing comments, Eileen, on this?
Excuse me, Chair Hacker. I think Mark Ransom's been trying to.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I just had a real quick one, and may not be the right audience, but I've kind of lost track of the master developer. You know, if there is indeed a master developer, you know, retained at this point with a development agreement with the city so that there's assurances, insurance as applicable, so that once, you know, all these timelines are achieved, that somebody's actually going to deal with the land as envisioned. So I don't know if that's a question for you all here or if that's more of a question for the city. So. But that's my question.
It is a question for the city, but we have a conveyance agreement with OCII, and OCII has an agreement with Five Point Holdings as the master developer.
Danielle, could you explain what the acronym OCII refers to?
Office of Community Investment and Infrastructure. So it's San Francisco's planning department.
Okay.
Thank
Mark,
you.
My apologies for skipping over you there.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Anything further from the team?
I guess I also just want to say thank you, Danelle and Tony, for coming, and Michael, and then thank you to our team, Nathan King, Mary Snow. You heard, you know, she's very active. Jessica Watkins and Selena Hernandez, they've all been very engaged on this project, and we're trying. So thank you to the community that, you know, we enjoy working. Nathan and I both grew up in San Francisco, so it has a special place in our heart to really want to see it. And Mary, too, that's right. Mm-hmm. So there's some special feelings here among the Water Board team that really want to work collaboratively with the Navy and EPA to get this all cleaned up so the community has a beautiful place. Yes.
Well, we wish you continued progress. I want to thank everyone for your participation and attendance today. The board is not meeting in closed session, so this concludes the public session of the May 14th, 2025 San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you for coming here to join us. Our next meeting is Wednesday, June 11th at 9 a.m. here in this auditorium. Thank you. I'd like to, in closing, also not forget to thank our very capable AGP team, David Fairbanks, Dakota Smith, and Cree Putney. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks, guys.